Low-income communities and people of color often bear the brunt of pollution. One former staffer at the Environmental Protection Agency says, instead of cutting the small office that helps these communities, the Trump administration should look at what it's accomplished.
If they were really looking for efficiencies, they would have put the Office of Environmental Justice at the top of the list of saving.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, we're talking about race, class, and environmental health. Plus, we visit a nonprofit trying to give a voice to people who believe fracking is affecting their health.
For policymakers to understand the level of impacts, we would need people to stand up and be counted.
And if you're confused about whether or not nonstick cookware is safe to use, don't throw out your pots and pans just yet. We've got some advice from an expert. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We've heard a lot about Shell's ethane cracker being built in Beaver County. Well, it could be just the first of several large chemical plants in the region. At a petrochemical industry conference in Pittsburgh, industry observers said the surrounding area produces more than enough natural gas to fuel additional plants. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
Shell's $6 billion Beaver County plant will use ethane from the natural gas found in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and West Virginia to make the building blocks of plastics. Currently, the region's ethane is sent to chemical plants in the Gulf Coast, Ontario, and Europe. But whatever ethane can't get sold to those plants gets mixed in with the gas that supplies homes and businesses for heating and cooking. The U.S. Energy Information Administration's Warren Vilchevsky says if all that leftover ethane were instead used to make plastic, the region would have more than enough to supply several big chemical plants without any need for additional drilling.
By our calculations, you could have easily another two or three world-scale crackers, and that demand could be satisfied with a sufficient cushion so that if you have an interruption in supply, you could still make it up somewhere else.
In addition to Shell's plant, which is scheduled to begin operations early next decade, companies are currently considering building ethane crackers in Ohio and West Virginia. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
As the oil and gas industry looks to the future, planning for petrochemical plants to use the abundant supply of natural gas in the region, others are looking around and wondering how all of that natural gas development is affecting their health. A number of studies have linked fracking and the pipelines and compressor stations that come with the well pads to health problems for people living nearby. Since 2011, the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project has been a resource for residents.
There are a number of people who we believe are probably too sick or just kind of frozen by anxiety to come to us maybe and receive our resources.
They perform health screenings, collect data, and try to help people protect themselves and their families from industry pollution. For our series, Hazardous to Your Health, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh and nearby communities, I spoke with the Environmental Health Project's director, Raina Ripple. We met at their offices in Washington County, which has the most active wells of any county in Pennsylvania. Ripple says the office is just 2 miles from one of them.
What kinds of stories do you hear anecdotally?
There's a lot of air emissions that happen on a regular basis, honestly. So we hear a lot about people saying, I'm getting a really intense exposure. These often seem to happen in off hours, so there's not a lot of regulatory action that can necessarily take place if something like that happens in the middle of the night. And with these acute exposures, they get these short-term symptoms.
Symptoms like?
Nasal irritation, respiratory problems, headaches, nausea, dizziness, shortness of breath, asthma, exacerbation. I mean, one of the things you have to understand about this issue, of course, is that a lot of people had certain respiratory conditions to begin with, because there is a long history, of course, of coal mining exposures in this area, bad air pollution that's coming from these various infrastructures that we already had in place. That said, a lot of the people that we talk to say, if I had these symptoms, they were never this bad before. The other thing I would just add to that is that across the board, stress, anxiety, sleep disruption, those kind of things are ubiquitous with this industry. One of our top concerns is the aldehydes as well as really the particle pollution. So you're talking about a lot of diesel type particles, a lot of particle pollution that actually we think could serve as a carrier for some of the toxic chemicals that might be associated with the actual fracking type operations. These particles getting into people's bloodstreams raises a lot of concerns for us. Formaldehyde is easily the most commonly understood aldehyde, but aldehydes is a class of chemicals, and these are the type of things we think might be causing the nose irritation, the eye irritation, so where it's affecting people's sensitive membranes.
So what kinds of data are you collecting and publishing or putting out to the public?
We've been working from a very citizen science perspective to get data in the hands of community members and impacted residents. So what we're trying to do now is pair that type of health assessment and air monitoring, and in some cases water monitoring data, with really a de-identified look. So it's HIPAA compliant, it's private health information. Of course, we can't put that out for the public. But we're trying to match up our health data in as confidential a fashion as possible with some of our air monitoring data and figure out ways to really get these pictures of the community-wide impacts online and put that in front of policymakers, educate also healthcare providers to say, listen, this is what your healthcare population and your patients are really being exposed to. We've collected over 600 data sets on air. We've got close to 400 health assessments to date. How do those two line up, and what do the community impacts look like?
And is there something that you can share with me today about what you found?
Yes. One of the things that we're now concerned about is the higher production levels seem to be causing more health impacts, and that seems intuitive, but if you, for instance, looked at an area where, say, you had 10 well pads and those were within a 1 mile radius of your home, you looked at another household that only had 2 well pads, it's not necessarily the number of well pads. It may be the production levels of the amount of gas coming off those 2 well pads. So if the 2 well pads are producing more gas than the 10 well pads, then it appears the household may have more symptoms associated with the 2 well pads. But this is preliminary data and we're still working to understand it.
I know you're advocating for a national fracking health risk registry. What is that and how could that help?
Well, at the very least, we think that people should be counted. How many people are there? Do we know? We don't really. And I think for policymakers to understand the level of impacts, we would need people to stand up and be counted. Beyond that, researchers need access to people who've been exposed, and we don't want them to disappear into the healthcare system without having the ability to go back and say, I once upon a time was in this area where the fracking happened. We could then, years down the line, with the assurance that this list is kept up, be in touch with them about the research, about the possible longer-term health effects. But if that population is never captured, it's reminiscent of asbestos and mesothelioma because, you know, you're going to have health impacts down the line. And people are going to need to understand where those health impacts came from. It's not an answer. It's not going to stop those health impacts from happening, but it puts more powerful tools in the hands of the affected individuals to say they can at least understand where they're at.
With what you've seen and the work that you're doing now, what's the action you'd most like to see taken in terms of health and unconventional gas development?
You know, quite honestly, I don't think we should be going full force without knowing what we're exposing people to. You know, we are right now conducting a vast public health experiment without the knowledge we need to know that it's safe. And when we started trying to parse the numbers out and say how close is too close, and especially related to vulnerable populations like children, the elderly, well, they're everywhere, right? So, and fracking seems to be everywhere too in certain communities. So there is no magic number. There is no safe distance that says, if you do this setback, we seem to be achieving a safe scenario for all. And so I think that at the very least, it could be time to really take a time out and say, hang on, let's understand this before we continue forward in this path. If there's not going to be a pause button, if we're not going to halt the level of activity, then at the very least, you need to have a robust public health infrastructure. You need to have a robust regulatory agency climate. We have the opposite. We have a Department of Environmental Protection that's had their budget slashed dramatically. We have a Department of Health that is facing consolidation of local public health departments. We don't have the resources we need from a state regulatory agency perspective to protect our health. And so the question then comes, are we able to do this safely? I think the answer is no.
Raina Ripple is director of the Southwest Pennsylvania Environmental Health Project. I spoke with her at their offices in Washington County for our series, Hazardous to Your Health, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. All of the stories in the series are at AlleghenyFront.org. This is The Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. For a lot of home cooks, there's nothing as satisfying as making the perfect omelet and sliding it out of the pan. And the pan matters.
One thing that all of the manufacturers of nonstick coatings agree that is if you overheat that coating, the fumes can be potentially dangerous.
Later on The Allegheny Front, keeping your Teflon pan in tip-top shape and some more savory alternatives. Stay tuned. When it was reported that President Trump's proposed budget for the Environmental Protection Agency cut money for environmental justice, Mustafa Ali resigned in protest after 24 years as head of environmental justice at EPA.
I needed to stand up and say that the choices and the proposed choices that were being made, that they would not be beneficial to the communities that I've dedicated my life to.
That's Ali talking with Vice magazine. Others in his line of work are also concerned about what's to come. They spent decades building an understanding of environmental justice within the federal government and building relationships with low-income and other communities throughout the country that are often left out of the conversation. For our podcast, Trump on Earth, The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and I talked with Lisa Garcia by Skype. During the Obama administration, she was senior advisor to the Administrator for Environmental Justice at the US EPA. She's now a vice president of litigation at a nonprofit called Earth Justice. So there's an official definition of environmental justice. You can go on EPA's website and take a look at it. But I'm just curious how you would explain it.
So environmental justice really speaks to the issue that there are communities, unfortunately, in the United States that don't reap the same benefits from environmental protections and really do have a burden of higher pollution and the resulting health disparities. So really environmental justice speaks to leveling the playing field, making sure that everyone has the right to clean air, to clean water, clean soil, and a healthy environment.
So could you give us an example? Is there a specific place that comes to mind where you'd say, here's a good example of how you could see that certain people just aren't being protected from environmental pollution?
Since I started out my work in New York City, I'll start with New York City. When I first was introduced to this concept, I started working with groups in the South Bronx. And it was really interesting to learn what the policies were for trash. You know, of course, they call it solid waste, but trash. Where is our garbage going? And realizing that in the South Bronx, there were 23 waste transfer stations that were handling a lot of the waste from throughout the city. It was a cumulative impact of all the truck traffic and all the pollution and the leaching and the smells, but then also beginning to scan out and look at the whole neighborhood. There was also a wastewater treatment plant, a sewage sludge plant. They were thinking of building a power plant, and there were rail yards and highways cutting off the community from other places, even from the waterways. And so that to me was recognizing that there's a huge burden on the population in the South Bronx. And of course, the environmental justice piece also speaks to communities of color being impacted. And this community had a high population of Puerto Ricans and Latinos. And then if you look at the resulting health disparities, they also had skyrocketing asthma rates.
We were kind of wondering where you grew up and if these kinds of things were issues in your community for you, for your family.
For a while, we did live in the Bronx, and I didn't know anything. I used to ride my bicycle around the block and go get ices around the corner. And I didn't realize that it was this hub of industrial pollution until much later. And I do have asthma. So I think coming to this and going back to the Bronx and working on issues, it also gave me this lens that we were such happy kids. And yes, maybe there was poverty or not as much access to resources, but we were very happy. And so I think that's what really drove me also, is wanting to make sure that people understood, when you say the words low-income communities or communities of color or indigenous populations, they are no different than Beverly Hills or any place else. The difference is how we politically make certain decisions and where some industrial pollution is, or access to education, access to healthcare. But that we're all, you know, we should all strive to make sure that happy kid doesn't end up having all those kind of disparities that are unnecessary.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how policy gets made that affects these communities at the federal level during your time at the EPA, or even before or after, since. What do you see as some of the successes, like the movement that's been made in terms of environmental justice?
I think, and this isn't certainly my success, it's mainly the community groups that always come up with some of the best solutions. If you think about the policies, even on something as straightforward as the agency is going to sue for violations of a permit, and some of the communities are saying, look, if you're going to have an enforcement action and there's going to be money coming out of an enforcement action, that should go directly back to the community. And so you're beginning to see settlements and agreements that really come up with, let's say, a health clinic for a medical clinic for a community that people had to travel an hour to get access to healthcare. Or one of the other policy issues that I think has been really helpful are grants, environmental justice grants, and you see them at the federal level and also at the state level, that help with this capacity building issue for communities, maybe to help hire an expert to sift through what an environmental review looks like, or having a map of where all those facilities are and what the cumulative impact might be, so that it's a savvy, informed community that goes to the public hearing and can really speak about those benefits.
Well, we're looking at proposed budget cuts for EPA for a lot of staff and programs. So what chance do you think that these efforts that you worked on, that others have worked on, have now under the Trump administration?
If you think about it, it's one of the only offices that is the liaison to communities that can't always fly to Washington, D.C. on their private jets. This is the office, and certainly there are regional offices also of environmental justice. They are in touch with people who are impacted by our bad past environmental decisions. So I think it's just a huge shame, and in my mind, the Trump administration did not do any homework, because if they were really looking for efficiencies and for value, they would have actually put the Office of Environmental Justice at the top of the list of saving, so that everyone could learn how efficient it is.
Well, Lisa Garcia, thank you so, so much. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much.
Lisa Garcia was senior advisor to the Administrator for Environmental Justice at the EPA, and joined me and the Allegheny Friends' Julie Grant by Skype for our podcast, Trump on Earth. The EPA did not respond to our request for an interview. There's much more of our conversation at trumponearth.org. You can subscribe to the podcast there, too. Trump on Earth is produced with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Researchers have found a family of chemicals called highly fluorinated compounds are contaminating drinking water around the country. Now they're trying to figure out whether filters really work to remove these chemicals from water. Rebecca Williams has more.
Highly fluorinated chemicals are used in making nonstick cookware, stain-repellent carpet, and water-repellent clothing. They've also been used in firefighting foam at military bases and airports. Those chemicals from firefighting foam have contaminated drinking water around the country. Chris Higgins is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the Colorado School of Mines.
We used to think things like PCBs and DDT were going to be the most problematic chemicals because they are really long-lived. These chemicals are much, much more long-lived than things like PCBs.
Higgins is an author of a study in the journal Environmental Science and Technology. He and his team sampled a groundwater well near a military base where firefighting foam had been used. They found two chemicals that are commonly found in that foam, called PFOA and PFOS, and 28 other fluorinated chemicals. Higgins says they ran tests in the lab to model how well a granular activated carbon filter would work on these chemicals, like the kind some water treatment plants use.
These filters have the capacity to work for these other chemicals. You just have to replace the carbon much more frequently.
And it's expensive to change out filters more often. He says this matters because unlike PFOA and PFOS, we don't know a lot about many of these other fluorinated chemicals.
I think the relevance for water treatment plants is we need to have a conversation about these other chemicals that might be present. And what is their importance? Do we care about them in terms of potential for toxicity? And do we treat for them even though we do not have information on their toxicity?
Higgins says reverse osmosis filters are the best technology to remove these chemicals, but they're expensive. Experts say there are about 3,000 highly fluorinated chemicals in existence, and we don't know much about most of them. Arlene Bloom is the executive director of the Green Science Policy Institute and a research associate in chemistry at the University of California, Berkeley. She says there's evidence of human health effects from exposure to the two chemicals we do know about, PFOA and PFOS.
We do know from human epidemiology studies that they're associated with a couple kinds of cancer, high cholesterol. For children, there's an association with reduced immune response to vaccines. And a series of other human health effects.
The EPA has set drinking water health advisories for PFOA and PFOS, but they're guidelines, not regulations. And when it comes to getting these chemicals out of the environment, that's another challenge.
That is the big problem. Since they don't break down ever, they're accumulating. And once we make them, they don't go away.
Bloom says the best way to deal with highly fluorinated chemicals is to think carefully about their use in the first place.
So I think each use of these chemicals should be thought out. Do we really need highly fluorinated chemicals, or could we use a safer alternative for this use?
She says when there aren't good alternatives, then fluorinated chemicals should be used sparingly. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
And if you want to learn more about where drinking water has been affected by these highly fluorinated chemicals, the Environmental Working Group has just released an interactive map. It's based on federal drinking water data and publicly documented cases of PFAS pollution from places like manufacturing plants and airports. EWG says the drinking water of 15 million people has been polluted by these chemicals. A link to their map is at AlleghenyFront.org. So the chemicals we've been talking about are used to make Teflon and other nonstick coatings slippery, so food doesn't stick. Most of us have one or more of these kinds of pots and pans in our kitchen cupboards. Are they safe to use? We decided to call up an expert, Jack Bishop. He's a chef and cookbook author and also the chief creative officer at America's Test Kitchen, where they review recipes and cookware. Hi, Jack.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
So if people have Teflon pans in their kitchen, are there health risks around those pans and what can they do to reduce them?
We're really talking about any pan with a nonstick coating. Teflon is the most familiar, but there are other nonstick coatings. But the advice is pretty much the same for all of them, that if you're cooking at home, there are two main things you want to be concerned about. One is that coating starting to wear away, in which case it is time to buy a new pan. You really don't want that coating flaking off and ending up in your food. The bigger issue is probably making sure you don't overheat the pan. One thing that all of the manufacturers of nonstick coatings agree that is if you overheat that coating, the fumes can be potentially dangerous. In fact, there are warnings about small animals, especially birds, being kept in the kitchen for just this reason. Those fumes really are not good for you. They can induce flu-like symptoms. You do not want to be heating the pan without fat in the pan. So a lot of times people will turn on the heat when they're cooking and then add the fat later. Put the fat in there at the very beginning because the fat will start to smoke at around 400 degrees before the pan reaches a temperature of 500 or 600 degrees where it will start to put off those fumes.
What about, they call them green pans or ceramic nonstick coating. I've seen those in stores. Is that the same as the other nonstick coatings?
No, they're ceramic-based. They don't have the same sorts of issues. But the problem is they don't work very well. They're not nearly nonstick enough. You know, if you're going to be trying to fry an egg and then get that egg to come out, you have to use a lot more fat.
Yeah. For people who are concerned about nonstick pans and want to move away from them, what are good cookware options, alternatives?
I think the original green nonstick was the pan that our grandmothers probably used, meaning cast iron. Cast iron will last a lifetime if you season it properly. It's almost as nonstick as a modern nonstick pan. Plus, it browns beautifully. You can cook a steak in it. You can bake bread in it. They are incredibly durable and are making a real comeback. Sales of cast iron pans are up significantly. The big things are don't ever soak it. Never, never, never put a cast iron pan in your dishwasher. You can use a drop of soap, but don't scrub it with Brillo. And avoid prolonged cooking of highly acidic foods. You don't want to make a Sunday ragu with a can of tomatoes and let it simmer all day in a cast iron pan because it will eventually peel off that coating.
There's another alternative that America's Test Kitchen has tested out. There was a big article on it, which is...
Yeah, you know, if you've ever been in the restaurant kitchen, you notice they have these super lightweight pans that have a blackened patina on them. They are likely what's called carbon steel. It's the same thing as cast iron in the sense that they are a mix of iron and carbon. Carbon steel skillets have a lot less carbon than the cast iron pans. They can make them much thinner and lighter. So they love them in restaurant kitchens where, you know, they're picking them up and shaking food. You wouldn't really want to be working 8 hours a day on the line with a heavy cast iron pan. Carbon steel is relatively inexpensive. You do need to season it when you get it home, but you season it once, and this pan will, again, last a lifetime. You can cook almost anything in it. It holds heat. It's easy to clean. We really love them.
Well, thanks so much for the advice.
My pleasure.
Jack Bishop is Chief Creative Officer at America's Test Kitchen on PBS. You can find a link to some of their other well-tested cookware recommendations at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. I'm thinking blueberry cobbler and a cast iron skillet. Maybe a little ice cream. Thanks for listening to this week's show. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Visit our website for all of our reporting in the Hazardous to Your Health series, looking at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. That's at AlleghenyFront.org. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, and the Benedum Foundation. The Pittsburgh Foundation supports our series, Hazardous to Your Health, examining pollution in Pittsburgh's communities.